absolutely aligned with the president. I'm absolutely appalled by how we've gone about it.
30 days isn't time to transform the supply chain. 30 days is time to maybe build up a little bit of inventory and to bring some parts over the border. But it's not enough time for transformation.
The vast majority of business people and politicians with a brain know that our number one priority is going to be onshoring national security and medical stuff, and then critical raw materials.
In the 1930s, we passed a law called the Smoot-Hartley Act, and it pretty much closed down world trade. This is how in the 1930s we all went bankrupt. That all these countries just suddenly started raising barriers once we'd raised our own barrier. And believe me, this kind of disruption economically can cause so much loss of value in the economy that you could be left with no capital to start over again.
So if we don't have a deal book by Monday evening, we got a problem. What was the mistake now that we're recording?
I think the...
Trump was a mistake.
Look, I stayed up front that I think it's very... Are we recording now?
Yeah, we're going.
Here's my view. I think the strategy of forcing our trading partners to come to parity in terms of trade restrictions is absolutely right. That's what the WTO was supposed to do 25 years ago and failed miserably. And the United States ended up after, from 1945 to now, constantly at the short end of the stick because we could afford to be. And because we were looking to save Europe, we were looking to save the world from communism. We were looking to save the ex-communist states. We were looking to help China, we were looking to reach out to China and help China modernize. All of these things we did for the benefit of our trading partner. And it worked incredibly well. We built up Europe. We saved a lot of countries from falling into the trap of communism.
We saved
the communist countries as they came out of communism. We did all of that. And we got China onto their feet, all at the cost of the American consumer, And here we are today.
And manufacturing base.
Well, yes, that's what at the cost of America, American population, and in particular the middle class. So here we are today, where the world has become flat, and America is right at the bottom of the heap. And I use the world has become flat because that was the war cry of the people who believed in free trade. Now, free trade is the way to go in the Ricardian sense. Everybody swaps goods that they are best at making, and everybody gets wealthier. That works until you have, one country being in the short end of the stick across the board because they're the wealthiest country.
Yeah.
So Trump is right that, the terms of trade are just manageable and that we can't continue to work that way. But this action does not seem to be well thought out. I think it's a mistaken way to go about it. I think that by all means, impose tariffs across the board on everybody we trade with with whom we have negative terms of trade. But the way they've calculated is crazy. And that, I think, is the problem with this entire situation. So I was quite positive up until the announcement. And once I read the announcement, I thought, oh my goodness.
Once that chart showed up.
Yeah. How in the world are you going to do this? Because what they've done is simply, taken the imbalance of trade and figured out this is the size of the trade. This is the imbalance. In order to make up that imbalance, divide the imbalance by the size of the trade. And that's the rate we're going to charge. Well, that's crazy. Yeah. I mean, it makes no sense at all.
Jeff, we spoke, 2 days before the announcement, I think it was, a couple of days before the announcement. And we were, coming up with a bunch of different, theories of what could happen. And then, the auto tariff thing came true at 25%, but there was a lot of other stuff that came through as well. So let's get your reaction on what you saw yesterday.
Yeah, I, being a party to you know, doing large deals and factories and acquisitions and being acquired. Sometimes when you're on the outside of a deal and you don't know what step you're at and you don't know the whole framework of the deal, things could look really good or really bad, you know, if you don't understand what's actually going to play out. Like Larry, I mean, obviously there's things here that look bizarre. Like, you want credibility when you put numbers out there. You want things to kind of be somewhat indisputable. That doesn't look like we don't have that. So yeah, I think there are areas to criticize, but from doing deals before, obviously nothing of the size of the entire global economy. It's difficult when you don't understand what end state looks like in the eyes of the principal. And I think that's a key thing that we need to understand. We've heard the words that they've said, but now it looks like they've said multiple different things. And that may be partly part of a negotiating tactic. I'm not sure. I think it's going to work in a lot of places. I think it's going to get mediocre results in some places. In some places, it may get really poor results. And so this is it's a dangerous approach to what's happening here. The whole approach to me is very precarious. At the same time, though, I'd be careful to just fully judge it and say it's a failure, you know, when they're, you know, however many hours into it. Here's what I think could happen. What I think could happen is number one, you have to get in the minds of the principals. Do the principals want to blow themselves up? Are they, you know, self-destructive? They, you know, literally want to strap whatever to themselves and blow themselves up. I don't think that's the case. And then the next question you have to ask yourself is, well, are they doing it unknowingly? And if you look at the people around them, Scott Bess and others, I mean, you could be critical. I mean, I've been critical. I wrote an entire article critical of the commerce approach to tariffs. But there are enough smart people around, I would say, that that's probably not the case, that there's enough information. So the way I see this flowing is, you know, number one, you have to start with the premise, and Larry laid this out, like, we actually don't have free trade. We want free trade, but if you look at the tariff and non-tariff barriers out there, that's just not the case. But then to say that your calculation is well, I'm going to take the trade imbalance that we have today, and I'm going to try to get every country to zero as an objective. Well, that's where I think people are like, what's going on? But I just don't know what stage we are at in this negotiation. Was the plan for shock and awe? It's as hot. Here's what I think is, the numbers are so high that they're not permanent, meaning, like, they're meant to be so high so that there physically has to be a conversation about taking them down. Versus if he set 5% and 10% across the board, I think there could have been more retaliation right away, and there could have been less real conversation about, like, how do you put all the real things up there, the real tariff and non-tariff barriers out there. So I think the higher number precipitates a larger, more in-depth conversation about how we restructure trade. It's arguable of, like, how this is being accomplished with ally countries, non-ally countries, and so forth. But that's where I think we're going. I don't think they're going to blow themselves up. And I do think the stage that they want to set, and I'll yield the mic back, is every day a deal folder is going to be presented to the president. And then he's going to have a press conference. In the White House, they'll get a gaggle of reporters and they'll open up a leather folder and say, we've now struck a deal with Israel. Israel's taken all of their tariffs to zero. We had a 17% tariff on them. We're going to take it to this. And then there'll be a signing. They'll take questions. Then you're going to see this continuous flow. I do think they want to flood the media with, you know, this was obviously shock and awe, but I do think they want to start flooding them with better news. You can say that's Pollyannish. You think everything's going to work out, but you have to start with the premise, like, are they trying to blow themselves up? And I don't think that's the case.
Yeah. Hans, let me go over to you. What's your mind?
Well, I guess I really just have more questions at this point than answers or comments.
Can I mention something first before you go on your question?
Go for it.
My very simplistic small brain view is that I've been around Persians and they love to haggle, and Trump is like that version, and he's very brash and weird, but he knows what levers he can pull to get people to the table. And this might be a very, like, this is where I agree with you, Jeff. I think this, I don't think he knows any other way. And this is, I think this has been Trump's sort of his biggest criticism through the years, is like he has his finger on the pulse extremely well, but the way he tries to execute against that is odd.
As far from kosher as possible.
Exactly. And especially for a realm in politics, which has been incredibly rewarding of polish over the years, and trying to look, you know, like Obama as the perfect example of this incredible statesman. And Trump is the literal opposite, but where he does a really good job is that he knows exactly what the issue is. He knows exactly what the issue is, and he acts against the issue, but the action is what gets people completely like all four of us, like, what is going on? But at least there's action against the issue. Anyway, I wanted to put that out there because, again, I think, you know, I think it's hard for me to feel like they don't know what they're doing now, but I could buy that what they're doing can have a lot of unintended consequences or a lot of sort of downstream effects, in the same way that a startup tries to move really fast and they on the path to the, or even at my time at Tesla, on the path to the end result, you have no barriers to keep you on track. And then you're just constantly going back and forth and laying a ruinous waste behind you. But then when you get to that end point, you look back, you're like, oh, wow, that all that was worth it. In politics, in public service, you get voted out every couple of years. You could be, you know, the House and the Senate could flip on you, right? So how much tolerance and the voting base is not going to have the same tolerance as the board of a company or your employees or your investors, right? They want their life to get better. It's a lot more emotional. So anyway, that is my naive take on it. And I'll yield the mic back.
I think this is one of the other quick reasons why he pulled the trigger on this 60 or 70 days or so into his administration, because I guess the midterms are, right, 700 or so days when the election occurs. And or how many days? Point is it's early, like in the first 10% or so of that 2-year cycle. Get this in there, get it going, shock and awe, get the results. And hopefully what we start seeing April through May are a series of deals that take these barriers down. But I do think the end state is there is going to be a new lower tariff barrier that wasn't there before across many geographies and countries. I don't know if I see us going back to zero, but having some small number that really drives onshoring back to the U.S. My old criticism of this whole thing of like knowing these schedules, knowing the unit economics and understanding how supply chains are designed, that the intentions are good, but if you could also get the same result by doing an escalating tariff on a proper schedule, working with these business leaders, like you could get the same results. The concern I have right now, if we were to start double clicking into auto, for example, is you are going to destroy the product lines and destroy the companies that could have been saved on a schedule, that you're going to destroy them in the progress of trying to bring them back. And that may in turn, I don't know, yield better. I don't think it's going to yield better results. I would have done the component tariffs, if they are going to come May 3rd, I would have done them more on a schedule. The final assembly tariffs, I don't know if I necessarily disagree with the approach and the timing.
So, and that's where my question was going to lead in, Jeff, was, you know, there are kind of two different groups of people broadly that you can think about in all of this process. There's the politicians who are going to be the ones who are responsible for engaging in this negotiating and deal-making process at the highest level. And then there are the actual businesses, which are the, you know, that's the goods that is being traded back and forth, essentially. And you obviously don't want to kill the horse before you trade it. But you also have to be able to make the deal. So how are you thinking about that tension between trying to preserve the businesses, the business interests, the economics that are at the lower level, and then the deal making that's happening between the United States government and the government of Israel and the government of France and the government of the UK, all of that?
And then if I can add one more small layer, and are they aware at how fragile some of these are, like auto? Like, are they aware of how fragile of a situation
yes.
the legacy automakers are in?
Yeah. I believe that they were presented, I believe that the auto leaders presented on a private phone call, you know, their situation on the final assembly side and probably the component side. And the question was it taken under proper consideration? And is some of this like, yep, we understand it, but let us do our deals with these countries and we're not going to kill you. I mean, that could have been part of the reason why they were on and off again in February and March. To give it some more time, but like 30 days isn't time to transform the supply chain. 30 days is time to maybe build up a little bit of inventory and to bring some parts over the border, but it's not enough time for transformation. So I think what end state would look like logically is we want to final assemble more cars here, and we're going to have this final assembly barrier. Like, you should be doing it, but there's two ways it's being done. There's three ways it's being done, actually. There's the Tesla Rivian way, where you do final assembly and you do all the complex, very high dollar parts. You do them co-located in the United States. And then there's the Ford
Everyone
way.
Else.
Well, I think there's about three things happening. And then there's, you know, you're doing a lot of final assembly in the U.S., but you're bringing a lot of components in from the outside. And then there's a third way, is what you've basically kissed, you know, you've done the bare minimum for the to get localization, like on the final assembly level. I think BMW, Volkswagen, BMW, a couple others do this, where you built a factory, it's got your logo on the outside, but what you're bringing in are more kitted components that have been pre-assembled somewhere else and either knocked down to a level that are the requirements to get made in the USA, or they're even not. The point is you don't have high labor, high content jobs in those factories, and you're just basically, you're meeting some trade requirement, but you're not actually driving employment. And I think the administration wants to get rid of that. And I think they want to drive is all the final assembly. If you're going to own a car in the US, I think they want it assembled here. And I think they want to get as many of the components around, you know, as possible, but that's going to take time, because these USMCA supply chains were designed over years.
Yeah.
I just want to make a real quick random observation that it's interesting to me that you identified BMW as one of the car makers doing like the bare minimum of the bare minimum of the bare minimum, and trying to rely on US labor as little as possible. And they are also the first and foremost partner of Figure and their robotics platform. So anyways, that's kind of a random observation, but it just clicked for me as you were saying that.
Interesting. Larry, go ahead. Yeah. You're muted.
You're still muted.
You're still muted. I can tell that there's a lot of cursing going on, though. Go ahead.
Look, I mean, the vehicle business is really, you know, a component of this whole thing, but I like to look at the entire end-to-end, because as non-surgically as they've approached the auto business in this bid of theirs, there are other industries where the complexities are even greater, believe it or not. I mean, I know the auto industry is very complex and it's a very complex product, but there are supply chains in so many different industries where goods move from the United States to overseas and then back here, and where goods move from source mines to China to back to Europe, back to China, to the United States. And then there's the delivery of goods into the United States of finished goods from all parts of the world, but particularly China, and all the aspects of packaging of those goods and the delivery of those goods. So, and then there's those goods that are designed in the United States, manufactured in China, and then exported to the United States. There are so many complexities in the supply chain of all the goods that the United States imports. And when it comes to goods, the United States imports a huge proportion of the goods that we consume, so that all of these complex supply chains are impacted by a very large percentage of the goods we buy. But the way And this gets me back to the first point I made, which I'm on a hobby horse now. Nobody's going to derail and get me off this horse. The problem is we've used such a broad brush to tar this entire process that every single good we end up with, whatever it happens to be, has in one way, shape, or form been through this process and now is being assigned a some sort of charge, some sort of duty at probably a different point, at multiple points in its journey. And so the cost of goods are going to go up by very significant numbers if these rates hold. And how were the rates calculated? The rates were calculated simply by dividing the total deficit we have with a particular country by the total trade of that country. And so it's like as blunt an instrument as you can find over an extraordinarily finely tuned process. So yeah. Given that negotiations can only be done relatively in parallel, given there are hundreds of different countries and many thousands of different goods, I don't see how we can achieve any substantive goal in any reasonable period of time before we dislocate world trade.
So can I play the devil's advocate? Oh, go ahead.
Before you do, I remind you we've done this once before in our history. So in the 1930s, we passed a law called the Smoot-Hartley Act, and it pretty much closed down world trade. It was part of the reasons that the 1930 Depression lasted so long and went so deep. It was like the second wave of the Depression that was so serious. And that was caused by the Smoot-Hartley Act, which really tried to achieve the very same goal. Now, conditions were very different then as they are now. It may even be worse than it was then. But my point is, I am absolutely aligned with what the president is trying to achieve. I just think that what he's done makes it so difficult to make progress, but so easy to tip world trade into a very serious recession.
Yeah. So I guess my devil's advocate side is, how else would you create the strongest forcing function or localization of production and supply chain creation without creating utmost uncertainty?
That's easy. That's very easy. You heard Jeff give a fairly well-viewed, logical solution, tackling it step by step by step by step. And I think that could be done in almost every single one of these industries, major industries. Look, there are really only five commodities that you absolutely have to be completely independent. You know, copper, gold, aluminium, steel, something else, I forget. But those five primary inputs, raw materials, you really need to have a very strong independent position. And that takes time. Then you get to the manufacturing, and manufacturing is not one process. It is multiple levels of process before you get to a complex good. You have to think about each level, and Jeff outlined for us in the auto industry how you would go about it. And that's just one industry. There are like several thousand industries that are, you know, very important to us that would need the same approach. All I'm saying is that I'm absolutely aligned with the president. I'm absolutely appalled by how we've gone about it.
Yeah. Jeff, go ahead.
I was wondering if there's a chief supply. I mean, we have a chief, we have an AI czar, we have a crypto czar, probably need a supply chain czar, somebody kind of floating around the White House that understands how products are made. Obviously, Elon is there, but I think he's purposefully... I'm sure he's consulted in many respects, but I also think that, you know, due to conflicts in his companies and so forth, you know, he's not going to add another hat.
He's made it clear
that this is not going to be good for Tesla. He's made it clear. So, Howard Lutnick is the guy. he's responsible, and it's his department that bears the responsibility. So Department of Commerce, that's it. And, you know, he has brilliant ideas, but to me, this idea is a little, as of yesterday afternoon at 4 o'clock, I was very confident that we were on the right track. You know, after the announcement, I thought, oh my God.
That chart is going to live in meme history. There's already a lot of memes. There's this one, I don't know if I should say it or not, but there is a, let's just say there is a very popular adult website that put his whole speech on there, and the thumbnail was Trump holding up the sign, and the title was "A President Screws 8 Billion People" or something. Anyway,
so.
Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, Howard, he has that. He has a Commerce Secretary title, but that's not.
It's not the expertise that's needed.
What product lines or what supply chains has he built in his career?
No, but within his department, he should have that expertise.
I'm saying, yeah, I agree with you. I'm just saying nobody's emerged. Nobody's given a statement. Nobody's, you know, when it
sounds
I
like read, Jeff is volunteering for the administration. No.
I read through that 400 page document or as most of it as I can. And it, there's an elemental analysis of the issues. But there's not a, like, here is the strategy, or here's the approach. Here's a layered approach on a schedule where you can get the results you want, which is end state over some period of time. It doesn't have to be 20 years. It could be fast, but it can't be in 4 days. And in between now and 4 days, or now and 30 days and May 3rd, you could cause a lot more destruction. And you may not have those industries here that you're trying to move back. By the way, there's a whole other conversation that floats under this, which are, do we have the workforce? Like, what have we been sending people to school for the last 2 or 3 decades? We've told everybody, you know, to write software. We've told everybody, you know, lawyer, doctor, go to liberal arts, engineering.
Don't forget about English majors. We've got a lot of English majors.
And grad school of all varieties.
There's nothing wrong with that, but that's not a manufacturing. We don't have people that know how to do this. Like, you're going to need tool and die makers. You're going to need a set of trades that, you know, honestly, it takes a long period of time to develop that. And the other thing is, when I brought a factory back here for smartphones in 2013, like, we were ready to go. We had pulled the processes back for like, okay, we're going to hire, we're in the middle of Texas. Like, there's going to be all these people. We need about 3,000 people. We're going to put it took us a long time to get critical mass in that factory, because we have these small components and assemblies that we were doing in China. And we had designed a process that was, you know, for this region and for the US, but not enough. And we found that people were really struggling to build things that were from other continents, and to do that labor here. So when you onshore, you have to onshore with a different identity, a different supply chain design, and then a different individual process design. You can't bring the engine and transmission assembly from Mexico that's designed for a $2 to $10 an hour labor rate and bring it up here for $50 to $70 labor rate. The economics will explode. You won't be able to get the people in time. You won't get the tool makers to make your tools and dies in time. You're going to be able to transfer the ones up from Mexico, maybe, but then you're going to need new ones, and who's going to make those? So there's a lot of things to think through, but these things can happen in phases. We have auto factories that are between 30 and 45% or so utilization. So you can bring more product in, but it's going to have to be this layering effect of like, okay, here's this phase. We're going to bring final assembly in. It looks like this. Okay.
So,
and then here's this next step. We're going to go one step lower in the supply chain, and we're going to bring these high content assemblies in. And this happens over this phase. And at the end of this phase, if you've not moved 75% of your product, you're going to get a 20% tariff. Something along those lines needs to be designed for this. And you can get both goals done. And if you're President Trump, you're thinking about your legacy, you want to look back and say, well, did I, at the end of it, did I develop an achievable process to move to onshore jobs here, or did I blow things up and kill the patient?
So, Jeff, just taking what you said and extending that to, I don't know, 30 to 50 other principal products that are important to bring to this country, we should have designed a program for each of those products. And that program should have said, over the next 5 years, we are going to impose this rate, then this rate, then this rate, then this rate on foreign assembled vehicles. And at that point, this will be the rate. When we've moved them 100% to the United States, this will be the rate. And so you take what you've said, talked about cars, but you would take that to all high value, added value products. And then you would also be very intelligent about applying tariffs to countries where they're adding value and where it would be possible to move the added value to the United States. And a thoughtful program like that could have been enacted not in 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. It may have taken, 6 months to a year to fashion it and to negotiate it one by one, one country by country. But at least that would have been an intelligent way to do it. This is impossible to implement, will lead to extreme difficulties, and will lead to much, much higher prices, and will have to be abandoned, within, 3 to 6 months, they're going to have to abandon this.
Can I throw something out there? So is the fact that they haven't done this a signal that says that their end goal is to have zero tariffs so that they don't have to wade through this complexity?
It is so complicated to move back to zero tariffs. It would be, you have to have a multilateral agreement of all parties to say zero tariffs. Because if we and China agree to zero tariffs, what about the tariffs on all the raw materials China is bringing in from all of the other countries? What about the sub-assemblies that they get from Indonesia? What about the, it is so complicated because
we're also intertwined already, that just having one country with another relationship, that can't stop there.
Yeah, because we can agree with China zero tariffs, but they're paying tariffs on goods that they're getting from Vietnam, or they're getting from wherever, Malaysia, or wherever they're getting it from, or from Australia. And so it becomes very difficult. I mean, Australia have imposed tariffs on their ores and their materials. So, it's a lengthy and complex process. And what they've tried to do is just throw a bomb and say, let's see where the pieces end.
Let's see who comes to the table and who doesn't, kind of thing. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. It's very interesting to see where this goes and whether or not this will work. I don't disagree there at all, but I'm just thinking about this, having observed Elon Musk do hard things that everyone said is impossible. And if we were presenting this plan to Elon Musk and we said, yes, and it's going to take us 2 years, he would say, fuck off, get out of here, come back to me with a new plan tomorrow or you're fired. And so that's where I don't know if, that doesn't necessarily mean that is the conversation that's being had at a high level, but it is possible. If the time is long, then the design is wrong, in my head.
Go back to first principles. The first principles here is this Ricardian idea of, we each exploit our best capabilities. And so we trade with each other. We are very good at this, and we supply you that. You're very good at that, you supply us that. That doesn't imply zero tariffs or as zero balance of trade.
Yeah, trade imbalance.
Some countries are going to have a surplus. Some will have a debt.
Yeah.
We'll have a surplus with some and a deficit with others. To expect to have a zero balance with all other countries, from a Ricardian point of view, from an economic point of view, it's crazy.
Yeah.
If a country has the only uranium supply in the world, you cannot expect them to sell that uranium, at an equal price that they would pay themselves for that uranium to the rest of the world.
And then you have education, culture. You have a bunch of other layers. I got to move real quick. I'm going to go on mute. Hans, if you can drive the conversation for me, that'd be great.
Yeah. So, I mean, what that point notwithstanding, Larry, that yes, this, so in, you know, I think it remains to be seen, is this idea of how we're going to balance the trade deficit, is that a red herring, or is that actually the tool by which they plan to measure progress and proceed with these negotiations?
Firstly, a zero balance of trade, a perfect balance of trade is not necessarily a good thing. When you're a reserve country, you expect some deficit, and probably a reasonable agreement with all parties throughout the world would probably lead to a very rapidly declining deficit. I mean, there's no doubt that the United States placed itself at a trading disadvantage to all its trading partners in the post-war years, because it had to get the rest of the world to recover, and it was an act of remarkable charity that led it to engage with its partners in this way. So there's no doubt that we're at a huge disadvantage as far as tariffs are concerned, and they have to be addressed. There's no doubt at all, and Trump is right in that regard. But he can't be right that we have to be at zero balance with the rest of the world. That can't be correct. Grows against all economic principles.
So why do you anchor on that? Why do you believe that that is his principled position and what he's doing just a negotiation?
Because I'll tell you why. I wrote today, I said that the amount of negotiation, the administration's approach can only mean that there's going to have to be hundreds of negotiations, country by country, but happening at a simultaneous moment. And we don't have the ability to do those multi-threaded negotiations, and the rest of the world's not going to sit or wait for their chance to speak. They're going to raise the barriers immediately, and they're already doing it. They're reciprocating. This is the nature of how Smoot-Hawley destroyed global economics in the 1930s. If the plan was, listen, guys, everybody has to come to the table. Everybody has to come to a more equitable basis. We're going to give you X number of months. We're going to give you Y number of years. We're going to give you this. And this is the plan. This is where we have to get to. I would have signed on. They didn't say that. They said, tomorrow, we take the total trade we have with you, divided by the deficit, and that's how much money we're going to charge you. That's got to be the worst way in the world to do it. And you're saying to me, yeah, but it's just a negotiating tactic. Well, how do you negotiate with hundreds of countries, literally 200 countries simultaneously? How?
Okay.
You wouldn't. You'd start with, you know, there's five economic zones that matter, and then you would spiral out. But your point is still valid of it's a bit of a bomb, and how do you deal with it simultaneously? I think it's a valid point.
So,
yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead. No, please go. Okay.
I lost my train of thought.
Oh, good. So let me walk down this path then. What do we need to see in the next 72 hours, or do we need to wait longer to see if this is a successful strategy or if it's going to be a total disaster? What variables are we looking for?
Do you need to see the administration willing to negotiate a major deal with a major country? So I would love to see a Mexico, Canada, or even an Israel start in terms of like, here's a deal folder, we have one. And then it's like, okay, well then this was the worst case view, and we're going to work on negotiating everything down. We're not going to bat 1,000. They're not all going to work. Some of them may take longer than others, but at least there's a willingness to negotiate. If you don't hear anything and it's just crickets, you have countries like Israel, again, that took their tariffs to zero, and there's no response from the administration. I think then there's a bit of a, you know, warning signs go up. But the way that these things work, and they work in various deals at different levels of structures always, you may hear some of the most bombastic rhetoric, especially in the first 12 to 24 hours, but they're also in a room trying to figure out, okay, what's a proper counter proposal and what's a proper deal to do. So they have to, because we're the nation that they're all debtors in terms of trade. Like they for 100 years, Canada has shipped 75% of what they make to us. So like they have to, that's not going to shift. That would not shift to other countries overnight fast enough to make them whole. So like they have to do a deal. It's a question of, have we put them in a position where they would do a deal and negotiate? Now, there's this situation there. There's an interim, you know, leader there. There's a new election coming up. So now you have posturing. I'd love to see something from Mexico, but I'd like to see a deal. I'd like to see some deal made. And I think with the president, knowing his style, this is very apprentice style of this reveal. I'm not happy about it, by the way, but in terms of these deals just starting to come out one after another and just dominating the news cycles of like, we're making deals and then calling people together. And, you know, he did it similar with some of the Mideast peace agreements, kind of one after another in the first administration. So we'll see. Like I said, we live in a 24/7 news cycle. We actually live in a news cycle where it's even greater than an hour. It's even every half hour, every 15 minutes, where now we have posts on social media, this country said this or that. And when you're microanalyzing like that, that's not the actual cadence of how some of this work actually happens. But yeah, you would, you know, if you're thinking in 24 to 72 hour blocks, you'd like to see that they're willing to negotiate and make a deal. Or have one deal done.
So if we don't have a deal book by Monday evening, we got a problem.
My opinion, I think it's indicative of something else. Yeah. My end state is that there is a permanent tariff barrier put up by the United States, but it's lower than where it is today. Significantly lower enough where you could build it in, you could model it in for global trade, and then people could figure out, you know, how to do it. Low enough where it still brings activity and onshoring back to the United States, and it still brings deal flow back here, but high enough where it doesn't cause this, you know, this panic.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, low enough where it doesn't cause this panic, or high enough to drive the deal flow.
Yeah, because I think, I mean, the whole rhetoric from the administration, from Lutnick specifically, has been Doge is going to cut a trillion, and then tariffs are going to raise a trillion, and then we're going to be creating the External Revenue Service. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't know how much of that is posturing, how much of that is negotiating. But if the one of the biggest mandates for the administration is to lower the debt, right? Unless you're able to cut $2 trillion, right? Somehow, which I think is impossible given our current politics today. You're going to have to raise money somewhere. So tariffs have to stay. And if that's the case, then it goes back to the point of the fact that they didn't have a very specific type of framework to implement these tariffs is the big concern. Because if you're really trying to raise a trillion, is this truly the way you're trying to raise a trillion, which is just throwing a number at the wall and then seeing where it sticks, you know?
Yeah. You just bought a new microphone, or you're going to buy a new microphone. What did that microphone cost you?
$199.
Okay. It's now gone up $299? To $400. It's now gone up to $400. Gone up from $200 to $400. Are you still going to buy it?
I'm going to compare it to other microphones that are out there.
They've all gone up.
They've all gone up?
They've all,
well, yeah,
every,
I'm going
to... Every microphone.
I'm going to buy it. Sure. I'll buy it. I will, because I can afford it. Yeah. My price elasticity is... for me, like, it doesn't impact me nearly as much because I'm very fortunate. But I can totally see your point where if you're a upstarter podcaster dude and you're trying to really up your quality for sound, all of a sudden now you've created a new friction, a new barrier to try and get that done. And so that, in theory, will slow down entrepreneurship in a way because they don't have access to those microphones.
I mean, you know, if we had the manufacturing base in this country, if we were able to take over and manufacture these things, it would be one thing. But we're not going to be able to. And at the same time, the products that we do sell are going to have barriers thrust against them by these trading partners. This is how in the 1930s we all went bankrupt. That all these countries just suddenly started raising barriers once we'd raised our own barrier. And, you know, it just is very unfortunate. And Jeff is right. This thing could have been done so easily. And look, we had every right to do it. We've been playing the fool. We've been played as the fool for the last 80 years. I'm freely admit it, and I'd freely say that it's time to redress the balance. But you've got to remember from an economic point of view, when you do redress the balance, you cause a huge shock to the system and a huge change in the system. The more you do it to a consistent process and that people can adjust their expectations, adjust their lifestyles, adjust their habits accordingly, the better it is from an economics point of view. But to do it in this way, I mean, can't believe there's a single person with their head screwed on right who would have done this. I mean, it's like, think about yourself as a business. You're manufacturing, I don't know, widgets, and you're selling all the widgets you can at $2. Now you suddenly go out and say, sorry, from today onwards, my widgets are going to be $6. What do you think is going to happen to your sale of widgets?
So on the flip side, isn't this the greatest forcing function to reduce labor costs that we have seen in recent times? And isn't this where automation... Yeah. So like if your cost of materials is going up, are you going to try to get innovative from a labor perspective or a production perspective?
Yeah, but I mean, that's a function of time.
Yeah, again, it's going to take time.
But you can't throw a switch. And believe me, this kind of disruption economically can cause so much loss of value in the economy that you could be left with no capital to start over again. That's basically what happened in the 30s. I mean,
and so now there's a reason why the market hated it yesterday and today. Like all the dynamics we're discussing today is literally why the market's doing what it's doing.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Now, if we'd done exactly what Jeff had spoken about, picked an industry, a country, you know, that was a big player, did the program, imposed those, and said to everybody else, hey, we're going to do this to you. You better get with the program. Let's get together. Let's figure it out together. That I would have got right behind. But this is like putting, you know, 5 bullets into the 6-chamber pistol and trying to, you know, duck the bullets.
It's the most evil Russian roulette game of all time. Real quick, before I throw it over to Jeff, S&P is down 4.5%. NASDAQ 5.6, Apple's down 9.5, Tesla's down 5.8. Go for it, Jeff.
There's some businesses that are going to be literally crushed by this, and the market will begin sorting through it. Right now, I think the market's just puking on kind of everything. You even saw gold go down, and so when you see everything go down, when you see you see the yields go down, you see gold go down, you see equities go down. That's when you have to start worrying about liquidity, looking at credit spreads. We were fine on credit spreads a couple of days ago. I don't know how fine we are today. But these are the things you have to look at. I was just going to make a comment in terms of this whole process of onshoring. One of the first conversations, this is one of the conversations you have on any product you're building, but then now you have to have it on kind of a portfolio level or a country level, which is, what do you actually want to onshore? You don't want to onshore everything. I don't think we want to build TVs here. I don't think we want to be the TV capital, flat screen TV capital of the world again. So I think part of the problem of throwing this bomb is you created a lot of noise. You've riled up Madagascar. You've riled up, the island with the penguins. You've done all these different things. But where's the summit on all the raw materials that are needed to reclaim ownership in EVs, to reclaim or to claim ownership on humanoids? Where's that manufacturing council that's set up so that we can own humanoids, own the merger of the AI brain, the manufacturing capability, and all the critical raw materials that are going to be needed to manufacture these things? And that's where the focus needs to be. It's like, it needs to be on what we want to build. And then how do we build that supply chain over a series of several years so that we get to that end point? And how do we accelerate it? How do we do things that are, you know, beyond the current course and speed to get there? But right now it's like, hey, they build TVs and they do all, I mean, it's BS. There's also critical industries that we have to do from a national security perspective. I think we should have more of our medical, we should not be reliant on other countries for, you know, medical supplies and so forth. So I think we have to pick
and anything national security.
Anything national security, medical, and then those forward tech industries relating to AI and relating to the hardware that enables that AI, those are the things that we should be carving out right now. And then we should have teams focus on how do we fund these teams? How do we accelerate these teams? How do we grow this effort? And then finally, you have to believe, you know, right now they're, you know, Scott Bessent said that they're focused. He's okay, this bomb has been dropped. And he's like, now I'm going on the Capitol Hill and I'm trying to get this tax bill over the line. So you'd have to think that they don't want to do all this work to get this reconciliation done and then have no economy there behind it. And they have the markets, you know, the liquidity's out, nobody's spending money, we're in a recession. You can't think that that's the goal of the team. But I agree with Larry, like that we're making decisions that with such high standard deviation that we could potentially cross over and have failure in one of those things. So, but you have to think that right now they're really focused on getting this tax bill through, and you don't want to have an economy that's destroyed. Then you lose all that credibility when you're trying to stitch this whole thing together. And that's what would lead into the midterms. So my gut tells me that there's a plan. There are emergency levers to pull if needed. But yeah, it sure doesn't look good from the outside in our 24/7 news cycle. It's gut-wrenching for a lot of people.
So the companies... Actually, go ahead, Hans, before I steer this a different...
The way that I'm processing this at this point in time, you know, I have no idea, just like the rest of us, what is in the minds of the actual administration and where they want to go. And I honestly, you know, I don't know nearly as much about this area as either Larry or Jeff. And as someone who also feels like what I say isn't going to make one difference, you know, one way or the other on how any of this stuff turns out, I'm kind of just thinking about it from an observer's standpoint. And so one of the ways that if this was going to end up in a good place, I would expect them to be thinking is, to Jeff's point, you know, we're not going to bring all this stuff that we have outsourced back into the United States. Like, there's a limited capacity for us to bring manufacturing here and to make products. And so we've got to prioritize what is it that needs to be made here versus what doesn't need to be made here. But I don't want to telegraph my moves so much that I let everyone know. Like, these types of things, I think, are extremely common sense. I think that, you know, the vast majority of business people and politicians with a brain know that our number one priority is going to be onshoring national security and medical stuff and then critical raw materials. And because of that, I think it makes trying to have the latitude to make the deals that you want to make maybe a little bit more difficult, because the end state is so predictable. And so, you know, maybe that's why the administration is being so volatile in their messaging around it, is to try and break the frame and create uncertainty, which obviously the market hates, around what in the end is actually a very predictable end state and outcome. And, you know, like I said, I have no idea if that's actually what's going on or what's not going on. I'm just saying that if this administration actually knows what they're doing, this is what I would expect them to be doing. And I don't think that the we're really just not going to care that much about most of these industries. I think that all of the pressure that is being, like, this is going to be something that gets treated as an 80-20. There's only going to be a few things that we actually care about, and we're going to want to get to deals on the things that we care about relatively quickly. And then I think a lot of the pressure on all the other stuff probably ends up getting lifted once we're on the other side of whatever this negotiating window looks like. And I think we also want to know who is actually going to be on our side. I think that obviously we would really like for Canada and Mexico to be great trading partners with us that are aligned with us on values that we can depend on as we rebuild all of our critical national security infrastructure, our medicine, but manufacturing as a whole. like, we're going to still want access to cheap labor. We're still going to want access to a lot of things that we're not going to want to happen here in the United States, but we need to have those things with partners that we can rely on. And honestly, from my perspective, and this is not to say anything badly about China, like, I would expect China as a great world power to try and exert the maximum amount of influence around the world as they possibly can. I think that they have done that. I think they've done that masterfully. I think they've done that far better than the United States for the past 30 years, and that the Belt and Road Initiative is, you know, an extremely effective way to exercise soft power. And I think that soft power has reached Mexico and Canada, and it has undermined the trust that the United States has in being able to rely on these people as partners who are aligned with our interests and not China's. And so I think that that kind of thing has to be reset before you can say, yes, Canada, yes, China, we would love for you to be our number one and number two partners moving forward. And so how do you have that conversation in a way that allows you to achieve your policy objectives and do your negotiating on a stage where you can't be straightforward and say the things that I just said?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I think that's a very fair point. And what's interesting about that too is, you know, the reason why China is China is because the United States outsourced a huge amount of its manufacturing capacity out to them. So this is our own doing in a way, you know. Now they capitalized on it. They have a culture of extremely hard work and, you know, like thousands of years of history and very proud people. And they saw an opportunity and they capitalized on it. And they are where they are because of it. But now I think I do want to shift this conversation a little bit though now, because there are going to be winners. Like let's say there is a situation where this uncertainty continues, or let's say this is the new normal where we have dramatically increased the costs of moving raw materials or sub-assemblies or whatever from one country to another, and it becomes net more expensive for the United States to import stuff, okay, whatever that may be. But before I keep going, do we have a little bit more time from the, we're an hour in, another like 15 minutes or
I'm
so?
Good.
Everybody good?
Good.
Yeah.
To just say that, and I really, really, really appreciate the points that Larry and Jeff are making, and they're right, and probably a lot more right than I am. And their concerns need to be, like, the people who are in power, who are making decisions, if they're not hearing these concerns, need to hear them. Because to Larry's point, especially, the world economy is very fragile, and global trade is not something that we want to treat lightly. And if they're not careful, they can blow some major things up that will produce the exact opposite outcomes that we want to produce. So anyways, I just wanted to make that clear as well.
Very few things are not held by duct tape, is what I've learned. Very few things are not held by duct tape. Held together by duct tape. Yeah, exactly. So there are going to be winners in this realm. And the winners, and this is a topic that we talk about a lot, but the winners are the companies that are already heavily localized that are going to not feel a lot of these tariff impacts, right?